294, Chapter 25 of Jane Eyre. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 294, Cooking Along. This episode brought to you by Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com. And links to all of our sponsors can be found in the sidebar of the show notes at craftlit.com. Please visit them, as their support for the show is one of the things that keeps it free for you. Well, hello. I have been cooking along this week, and I'm going to give you some links. A long, long time ago, I followed our designer Erica's advice. This is Erica of Jane's Ubiquitous Shawl fame. I followed her advice and her instructions, and I made yogurt, homemade yogurt, in my crock pot. We are currently living in a house with a very small kitchen, and I had despaired about being able to make my own yogurt, but I just got inspired this last weekend and went crazy, and I made not only homemade yogurt, but I also made sourdough bread gluten-free. Now, the yogurt first. I found a really cool video that I'm going to pass along to you called Salad in a Jar, where she shows an alternative method for draining the whey out of your yogurt. The piece that she uses is fairly inexpensive if you get it from a hardware store, like a kitchen hardware store, but it costs a nice chunk of change if you think you're going to get it from Williams-Sonoma. So you have a couple of choices there. A fairly wide set of choices. And I found that, you know, hanging, like when you make jelly, it's easier to put all the jelly blah into a cheesecloth and hang it from one of my cabinet handles, so that everything just drips through gravity down through the cheesecloth and into the bowl. Well, with the yogurt, sometimes it doesn't set quite well enough, and I've been using tea towels for straining the yogurt. This works just fine, except that the stuff that's touching the tea towel, that gets thicker faster than the stuff in the middle, and so sometimes you have to kind of reach in and blush it all around and kind of go blah, 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 and get it to move again in order to get enough of the whey out to make the fabulous Greek yogurt that everybody is raving about right now. Either way, the salad in a jar woman is fascinating. I had no idea she was out there. I had not seen her thing, but her video for how to put salad in a jar was really fascinating. I don't have the tool she used, but now I'm thinking about it. Maybe someday in my future, when I have a kitchen again, maybe I'll do that. The other thing was sourdough. I don't know how many of you have tried to do sourdough in your own world before, but people get very riled up about how they make their starter and what's the right way to make their starter. And if you don't do it this way, then you're not really making starter. Life is too short. My feeling is I'm going to make what works. And what I found was, on red cabbage, I'm trying to remember the list because it was interesting. It was red cabbage, raisins, blueberries, organic apples, anything that hasn't been sprayed with a pesticide. You know how there's that kind of white film that you sometimes see on those items? Well, that's natural yeast. That's the stuff you're trying to capture from the air if you're going to make your starter. So you can kind of jumpstart the starter process if you mix up some of your flour and some water, preferably not tap water because that would have chlorine in it. So if you have like a Brita filter or one of the new filters, or you have filtered water, you can use that, mix that with your flour, And then some people just leave that open to the elements in your kitchen and expose it to air for a couple of days, and it will slowly start to bubble and do its little sourdough bacterial thing. And of course, one of the cool things about the yeasty bacteria that you are collecting from the air is that it actually keeps that stuff from rotting. I don't understand this magic. I'm just here to tell you that it's been working for me. I've been using a blend, if any of you are gluten-free, a blend of ancient grains with a little brown rice flour, not much, sorghum, amaranth, quinoa, a little teff, sometimes a little buckwheat. I make a nice blend of all of that, and I'm using that to feed the starter along with filtered pitcher water. And I'm not joking. I found a great sourdough recipe. I've had two very good loaves made, and I'm sharing it on the Mama Own Knits blog. Just not right away yet. First, I'm finalizing Defarge 2, and then I'm going to post that blog. But I wanted to let you know it's coming, because people will tell you it can't be done, and it can be. And finally today, I know you're going to be excited, you quilters out there. I know I don't quilt enough for you, and I apologize for that, but I'm going to make it up right now, at least briefly, and by letting you know that there might be a quilting pattern in the next Madame Defarge book. Not the current one that's coming out in a couple of weeks, not Shakespeare, because that one's already in the can, basically, but Sherlock. I know, right? Well, for you quilters, I do have some news. Our friend Jamie Guthels has sent us a press release, something that I have newfound appreciation and adoration when it comes to. She wanted to let you know that Worldwide Quilting Day events include storefront celebrations and special sales, charity drives, online giveaways, and the Seven Summits Strip Quilt Challenge. And this Worldwide Quilting Day is, if you're listening in real time, this Saturday, March 16th. Now, we have links on the show notes for episode 294. And just to let you know, I mean, we know that we have 3 million knitters right now in Ravelry. Well, there are more than 21 million quilters in the United States, which just makes me think, we have 21 million people who are actually able of being precise when they cut pieces of fabric. So it's just me. I'm the only one who can really seriously only manage a crazy quilt. Oh, it made me hurt. Anyway, that was as of the 2010 Quilting in America study. But all kidding aside, Worldwide Quilting Day and the Seven Summits Strip Quilt Challenge are designed to drive quilters to come together on March 16th to make as many strip quilts as they can in a single day. Quilt shops and quilting groups around the globe will attempt to piece together strips of fabric to make strip quilt tops. They'll be counting every inch of fabric sewn together in their shop or by their customers, with the goal of piecing together enough fabric to reach the peak of one of the seven summits. Now, if you're saying to yourself, summit? What? Huh? One quote is, maybe a shop will only be able to summit Mount McKinley, creating 152 quilts, but we'd love to see every shop make it to the top of Mount Everest, which would be the equivalent of 218 quilts. So, there. So, please visit the show notes at craftlit.com for episode 294 in order to get links to more information and daily giveaways in preparation for and in celebration of Worldwide Quilting Day on March 16th. There is a hashtag, a Twitter hashtag. We have that on the show notes as well. And then finally, I have one brief public service announcement for you. That is this. Alice in Wonderland, done, audiobooked, in the shop. So if you are not a subscriber and you would like to listen to Alice in Wonderland as a total audiobook, please visit our shop. That's crafting-a-life.com/shop. And one of the cool things about the way that we are presenting that audiobook to you is that you have two choices. You can download just the MP3 file, or you might prefer to download the MP3 audiobook file and the video files, so that if you decided after a while, you know what, I really do want to see the John Tenniel illustrations just right there on the screen of my phone or iTouch or computer, then it's an option for you. So we have it bundled two different ways. The other thing is, if you didn't sign up for the Craftlit Just the Books newsletter, you may not have heard that I finally figured out how I can do The Great Gatsby. You know, since the Baz Luhrmann movie trailers started coming out, I have been horrified and very upset and trying to figure out a way to do The Great Gatsby on the podcast. And finding a way to get the rights or to license this kind of audio is tantamount to climbing Everest with nothing but a pair of bicycle shorts and a t-shirt on. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I'm sure it's much easier for people who have a whole company. Like, you know, if they were a whole audiobook company and they had minions that they could order around. But when it's just me and Penny and Elizabeth trying to do what we can do when we've got time to do it, holy smoke, man. So instead, it occurred to me, I don't need the audiobook. I can do a just the benefits version instead of an audiobook with benefits version. So you will have me chatting up a chapter and then saying, okay, go off and either read or listen to the chapter on your own, and then come back after you're done and listen to the after chapter bit. And then we'll just do that for each chapter. Now, I am currently listening, because I wanted to make sure there was a decent audiobook version to recommend to you, I'm currently listening to Tim Robbins read The Great Gatsby. And I thought, you know, he has a good kind of a timbre to his voice for Nick. I wasn't sure how he was going to do with all the many other characters in that book. And I am here to tell you, does that man rock Gatsby or what? So if you're intrigued and interested, it's not an expensive audiobook download, because the book is older. Most of the audiobook downloads, even if you don't have a credit that you can spend on it, they're only like $5.95, $6.95, $7.95, something like that. And that's not bad for a whole audiobook. So The Great Gatsby benefits only version is coming your way. I am starting on it this week. And yes, Chaucer is coming. I had a brainstorm about how to reorganize one part of it, but I am still actively working on Chaucer. It will come. I know you have the first two pieces and they're massive, but the new one is coming. So all sorts of exciting things are in the work. If you haven't signed up for the Craftlit and Just the Books newsletter, I did say during the sign-up process that I wasn't going to be spamming people and I wasn't going to be emailing very often unless there was something to tell you. And this week I realized, oh no, there's actually something to tell you. So there went the first newsletter. We have a link to the archive version of that newsletter in the show notes at both Just the Books and at Craftlit. So if you want to see what the buzz is, you can go take a look for yourself. Now, on to Jane Eyre. This week's chapter, we're prepared for, right? We're ready. We're ready for Jane and Rochester to get married. We're there. We're there with them. We're on it. We're supportive. But we know something's not quite right. And so does Jane. And she clearly doesn't know what's not right in specific terms, but something is bubbling around in her subconscious. And this chapter, you know, I said we were heading into a more gothic section of the book where you can really start to see Charlotte Bronte's love of those, they weren't penny dreadfuls yet, but those kinds of magazines that had lots of melodramatic literature. And I've joked about it, you know, the I must pay the rent, you can't pay the rent, I'll pay the rent, that kind of thing. So we know that she has a proclivity for that. And we know that she's too good a writer to leave it at that. But even more than that, Charlotte Bronte is not going to waste the beauty of a device like foreshadowing or like using dreams in a way to elaborate on or illuminate something about the characters that she has clearly come to love as much as we do. So as a consequence, you're going to hear, for the first time in a while, a lot of things that sound and feel very symbolic. And I'm here to tell you, they are. And I can't tell you why yet. So I'm sorry about that, but it just would spoil all the fun. So remember this chapter, hold it in your mind and in your heart, and then just move on, because for another couple of episodes, we're not going to be able to talk about what's going on here, except to say it matters. And in fact, there have been times before where I've said, you know, go back and listen to this section again. This is one of those chapters that I go back and listen to, because it doesn't really sound on first listen like anything major is happening. There's a long conversation between Jane and Rochester, which is always fun. But it doesn't feel all that momentous necessarily. But go back and listen to it again and you start to go, oh, I wonder what that's about. So it's kind of a fun chapter in that respect. Now, Charlotte does do some things that bear some explanation in this chapter. You will hear our reader comment on staying at blank hotel. And this is one of those places where in the actual text of the narrative, there would have been a long underscore, a blank space, instead of giving you the name of a hotel or coming up with a fictitious name of a hotel. Charlotte also does something in this chapter that I find fascinating, because she doesn't do it very often. But when she does, it stands out. And I haven't really figured out why she does it here, except that it's beautiful. And sometimes I think that's enough of a reason. Charlotte directly addresses you, or at least she has Jane directly address you in this chapter, just once and towards the beginning. But it stands out. In fact, it stands out so much that when I was listening to this chapter again, because, you know, I listened to it a bunch before I record the podcast, I think I was making a left-hand turn. And so I'm paying attention to driving, but I'm hearing the book in the background, and I've got paper on the seat next to me to take notes on if something strikes me. And I'm making a left-hand turn, and it hits me what she just did. And I thought, oh, I'm glad I didn't just stop in the middle of the street, which was kind of my first impulse to go, oh, wow, that is interesting. That is odd. So she does do a bit of direct address in this just once, and it's lovely. She also, and I think this is just a Charlotte thing, because remember, this is, what, 40 years? 40 years before Dracula? Almost 50 years before, maybe it is 50 years before Dracula's written. She mentions the word vampire, but she connects it to German and Germany, which I think is probably a fairly simple mistake to make. And she did live in Brussels. We don't know what stories she had come across in Brussels, but it's very possible that the vampire stories that she had access to when she was in the continent, or the vampire stories that she had access to when she was reading her magazines, were connected to Germany. So we, who've listened to Dracula and know more of the history of a vampire, we may hear that and go, what? And I think it's probably a fairly simple and forgivable moment of ignorance on Charlotte Bronte's part. Now, one other thing happens in this chapter that you need to pay attention to, but you also need to not discredit, which is very hard for us in our modern world. But I think it's almost like it spoils something if you get too modern and too cynical in a book like this, but also with a moment like this. Rochester is going to talk about hearing Jane's voice. Let it flow over you. Don't resist it. Don't fight it. Don't raise your eyebrows. Just let it be. But also remember that it happened. And you'll see why I'm saying this much later, but just let it be its own thing and be okay with that. I think it'll make other parts of the book that much more enjoyable for you. All right. I think we're ready. Big fun. No whammies. Let's listen to chapter 25 of Jane Eyre. By Charlotte Bronte.
The month of courtship had wasted. Its very last hours were being numbered. There was no putting off the day that advanced, the bridal day, and all preparations for its arrival were complete. I, at least, had nothing more to do. There were my trunks, packed, locked, corded, ranged in a row along the wall of my little chamber. Tomorrow at this time they would be far on their road to London, and so should I. Or rather, not I, but one Jane Rochester, a person whom as yet I knew not. The cards of address alone remained to nail on. They lay, four little squares, in the drawer. Mr. Rochester had himself written the direction, Mrs. Rochester, Blank Hotel, London, on each. I could not persuade myself to affix them, or to have them affixed. Mrs. Rochester? She did not exist. She would not be born till tomorrow, sometime after 8 o'clock a.m., and I would wait to be assured she had come into the world alive before I assigned to her all that property. It was enough that in yonder closet, opposite my dressing-table, garments said to be hers had already displaced my black stuff low-wood frock and straw bonnet, for not to me appertained that suit of wedding raiment, the pearl-coloured robe, the vapoury veil pendant from the usurped portmanteau. I shut the closet to conceal the strange wraith-like apparel it contained, which at this evening hour, 9 o'clock, gave out certainly a most ghostly shimmer through the shadow of my apartment. "I will leave you by yourself, white dream," I said. "I am feverish. I hear the wind blowing. I will go out of doors and feel it." It was not only the hurry of preparation that made me feverish, not only in the anticipation of the great change, the new life which was to commence tomorrow. Both these circumstances had their share, doubtless, in producing that restless, excited mood which hurried me forth at this late hour into the darkening grounds. But a third cause influenced my mind more than they. I had at heart a strange and anxious thought. Something had happened which I could not comprehend. No one knew of or had seen the event but myself. It had taken place the preceding night. Mr. Rochester that night was absent from home, nor was he yet returned. Business had called him to a small estate of 2 or 3 farms he possessed 30 miles off. Business it was requisite he should settle in person, previous to his meditated departure from England. I now waited his return, eager to disburden my mind and to seek of him the solution of the enigma that perplexed me. Stay till he comes, reader, and when I disclose my secret to him, you shall share the confidence. I sought the orchard, driven to its shelter by the wind, which all day had blown strong and full from the south, without, however, bringing a speck of rain. Instead of subsiding as night drew on, it seemed to augment its rush and deepen its roar. The trees blew steadfastly one way, never writhing round, and scarcely tossing back their boughs once in an hour. So continuous was the strain bending their branchy heads northward, the clouds drifting from pole to pole, fast following mass on mass. No glimpse of blue sky had been visible that July day. It was not without a certain wild pleasure I ran before the wind, delivering my trouble of mind to the measureless air-torrent thundering through space. Descending the laurel walk, I faced the wreck of the chestnut tree. It stood up black and riven. The trunk split down the centre, gasped ghastly. The cloven halves were not broken from each other, for the firm base and strong roots kept them unsundered below. Though community of vitality was destroyed, the sap could flow no more, the great boughs on each side were dead, and next winter's tempest would be sure to fell one or both to earth. As yet, however, they might be said to form one tree, a ruin, but an entire ruin. "You did right to hold fast to each other," I said, as if the monster splinters were living things and could hear me. "I think, scathed as you look, and charred and scorched, there must be a little sense of life in you yet, rising out of that adhesion at the faithful, honest roots. You will never have green leaves more, never more see birds making nests and singing idols in your boughs. The time of pleasure and love is over with you, but you are not desolate. Each of you has a comrade to sympathize with him in his decay." As I looked up at them, the moon appeared momentarily in that part of the sky which filled their fissure. Her disk was blood-red and half-overcast. She seemed to throw on me one bewildered, dreary glance, and buried herself again instantly in the deep drift of cloud. The wind fell for a second round Thornfield, but far away over wood and water poured a wild, melancholy wail. It was sad to listen to, and I ran off again. Here and there I strayed through the orchard, gathered up the apples with which the grass round the tree roots was thickly strewn. Then I employed myself in dividing the ripe from the unripe. I carried them into the house and put them away in the storeroom. Then I repaired to the library to ascertain whether the fire was lit, for though summer, I knew on such a gloomy evening Mr. Rochester would like to see a cheerful hearth when he came in. Yes, the fire had been kindled some time, and burnt well. I placed his armchair by the chimney corner. I wheeled the table near it. I let down the curtain, and had the candles brought in ready for lighting. More restless than ever, when I had completed these arrangements, I could not sit still, nor even remain in the house. A little timepiece in the room and the old clock in the hall simultaneously struck 10. "How late it grows," I said. "I will run down to the gates. It is moonlight at intervals. I can see a good way on the road. He may be coming now, and to meet him will save some minutes of suspense." The wind roared high in the great trees which embowered the gates, but the road, as far as I could see, to the right hand and the left, was all still and solitary, save for the shadows of clouds crossing it at intervals as the moon looked out. It was but a long, pale line, unvaried by one moving speck. A puerile tear dimmed my eye while I looked, a tear of disappointment and impatience. Ashamed of it, I wiped it away. I lingered. The moon shut herself wholly within her chamber, and drew close her curtain of dense cloud. The night grew dark. Rain came driving fast on the gale. "I wish he would come! I wish he would come!" I exclaimed, seized with hypochondriac foreboding. I had expected his arrival before tea. Now it was dark. What could keep him? Had an accident happened? The event of last night again recurred to me. I interpreted it as a warning of disaster. I feared my hopes were too bright to be realized, and I had enjoyed so much bliss lately that I imagined my fortune had passed its meridian and must now decline. "Well, I cannot return to the house," I thought. "I cannot sit by the fireside while he is abroad in inclement weather. Better tire my limbs than strain my heart. I will go forward and meet him." I set out. I walked fast, but not far. Ere I had measured a quarter of a mile, I heard the tramp of hoofs. A horseman came on full gallop. A dog ran by his side. Away with evil presentiment! It was he. Here he was, mounted on Mesrour, followed by Pilot. He saw me, for the moon had opened a blue field in the sky, and rode in it watery bright. He took his hat off and waved it round his head. I now ran to meet him. "There!" he exclaimed, as he stretched out his hand and bent from the saddle. "You can't do without me, that is evident. Step on my boot-toe, give me both hands. Mount." I obeyed. Joy made me agile. I sprang up before him. A hearty kissing I got for a welcome and some boastful triumph, which I swallowed as well as I could. He checked himself in his exultation to demand, "But is there anything the matter, Janet, that you come to meet me at such an hour? Is there anything wrong?"
"No, but I thought you would never come. I could not bear to wait in the house for you, especially with this wind and rain."
"Rain and wind, indeed! Yes, you are dripping like a mermaid. Pull my cloak round you. But I think you are feverish, Jane. Both your cheek and hand are burning hot. I ask again, is there anything the matter?"
"Nothing now. I am neither afraid nor unhappy."
"Then you have been both."
"Rather. But I'll tell you all about it by and by, sir, and I dare say you will only laugh at me for my pains."
"I'll laugh at you heartily when tomorrow is past. Till then I dare not. My prize is not certain. This is you who have been as slippery as an eel this last month and as thorny as a briar rose. I could not lay a finger anywhere, but I was pricked, and now I seem to have gathered up a stray lamb in my arms. You wandered out of the fold to seek your shepherd, did you, Jane?"
"I wanted you. But don't boast. Here we are at Thornfield. Now let me get down." He landed me on the pavement. As John took his horse and he followed me into the hall, he told me to make haste and put on something dry, and then return to him in the library, and he stopped me as I made for the staircase to extort a promise that I would not be long. Nor was I long. In 5 minutes I rejoined him. I found him at supper.
"Take a seat and bear me company, Jane. Please God, it is the last meal but one you will eat at Thornfield Hall for a long time."
I sat down near him, but told him I could not eat.
"Is it because you have the prospect of a journey before you, Jane? Is it thoughts of going to London that takes away your appetite?"
"I cannot see my prospects clearly tonight, sir, and I hardly know what thoughts I have in my head. Everything in life seems unreal."
"Except me. I am substantial enough. Touch me.
You, sir, are the most phantom-like of all. You are a mere dream. He held out his hand, laughing.
Is that a dream?
Said he, placing it close to my eyes. He had a rounded, muscular, and vigorous hand, as well as a long, strong arm. Yes, though I touch it, it is a dream, said I, as I put it down from before my face. Sir, have you finished supper?
Yes, Jane.
I rang the bell and ordered away the tray. When we were again alone, I stirred the fire and then took a low seat at my master's knee. It is near midnight, I said.
Yes, but remember, Jane, you promised to wake with me the night before my wedding.
I did, and I will keep my promise, for an hour or two at least. I have no wish to go to bed.
Are all your arrangements complete?
All, sir.
And on my part likewise, he returned. I have settled everything, and we shall leave Thornfield tomorrow, within half an hour after our return from church.
Very well, sir.
With what an extraordinary smile you uttered that word, very well, Jane. What a bright spot of colour you have on each cheek, and how strangely your eyes glitter. Are you well?
I believe I am.
Believe? What is the matter? Tell me what you feel.
I could not, sir. No words could tell you what I feel. I wish this present hour would never end. Who knows with what fate the next may come charged?
This is hypochondria, Jane. You have been overexcited or overfatigued.
Do you, sir, feel calm and happy?
Calm? No. But happy. To the heart's core.
I looked up at him to read the signs of bliss in his face. It was ardent and flushed.
"Give me your confidence, Jane," he said. "I relieve your mind of any weight that oppresses it by imparting it to me. What do you fear? That I shall not prove a good husband?"
"It is the idea farthest from my thoughts."
"Are you apprehensive of the new sphere you are about to enter, of the new life into which you are passing?"
"No."
"You puzzle me, Jane. Your look and tone of sorrowful audacity perplex and pain me. I want an explanation."
"Then, sir, listen. You were from home last night."
"I was. I know that, and you hinted a while ago at something which had happened in my absence. Nothing probably of consequence, but in short it has disturbed you. Let me hear it. Mrs. Fairfax has said something, perhaps, or you have overheard the servants talk. Your sensitive self-respect has been wounded."
"No, sir. It struck 12. I waited till the timepiece had concluded its silver chime, and the clock its hoarse, vibrating stroke, and then I proceeded. All day yesterday I was very busy, and very happy in my ceaseless bustle, for I am not, as you seem to think, troubled by any haunting fears about the new sphere, etc. I think it a glorious thing to have the hope of living with you, because I love you. No, sir, don't caress me now. Let me talk undisturbed. Yesterday I trusted well in Providence, and believed that events were working together for your good and mine. It was a fine day, if you recollect. The calmness of the air and sky forbade apprehensions respecting your safety or comfort on your journey. I walked a little on the pavement after tea, thinking of you, and I beheld you in imagination so near me I scarcely missed your actual presence. I thought of the life that lay before me. Your life, sir. An existence more expansive and stirring than my own. As much more so as the depths of the sea to which the brook runs are than the shallows of its own straight channel. I wondered why moralists call this world a dreary wilderness. For me it blossomed like a rose. Just at sunset the air turned cold and the sky cloudy. I went in. Sophie called me upstairs to look at my wedding dress, which they had just brought, and under it in the box I found your present, the veil which, in your princely extravagance, you sent for from London. Resolved, I suppose, since I would not have jewels, to cheat me into accepting something as costly. I smiled as I unfolded it, and devised how I would tease you about your aristocratic tastes, and your efforts to mask your plebeian bride and the attributes of a peeress. I thought how I would carry down to you the square of unembroidered blonde I had myself prepared as a covering for my low-born head, and ask if that was not good enough for a woman who could bring her husband neither fortune, beauty, nor connections. I saw plainly how you would look, and heard your impetuous republican answers, and your haughty disavowal of any necessity on your part to augment your wealth or elevate your standing by marrying either a purse or a coronet.
"How well you read me, you witch!"
interposed Mr. Rochester.
"But what did you find in the veil besides its embroidery? Did you find poison or a dagger that you look so mournful now?"
No, no, sir. Besides the delicacy and richness of the fabric, I found nothing save Fairfax Rochester's pride, and that did not scare me, because I am used to the sight of the demon. But, sir, as it grew dark, the wind rose. It blew yesterday evening, not as it blows now, wild and high, but with a sullen, moaning sound, far more eerie. I wished you were at home. I came into this room, and the sight of the empty chair and fireless hearth chilled me. For some time after I went to bed, I could not sleep. A sense of anxious excitement distressed me. The gale still rising seemed to my ear to muffle a mournful undersound. Whether in the house or abroad, I could not at first tell, but it recurred, doubtful yet doleful at every lull. At last I made out it must be some dog howling at a distance. I was glad when it ceased. On sleeping, I continued in dreams the idea of a dark and gusty night. I continued also the wish to be with you, and experienced a strange, regretful consciousness of some barrier dividing us. During all my first sleep, I was following the windings of an unknown road. Total obscurity environed me. Rain pelted me. I was burdened with the charge of a little child, a very small creature, too young and feeble to walk, and which shivered in my cold arms and wailed piteously in my ear. I thought, sir, that you were on the road a long way before me, and I strained every nerve to overtake you, and made effort on effort to utter your name and entreat you to stop. But my movements were fettered, and my voice still died away inarticulate, while you, I felt, withdrew farther and farther every moment. And those dreams weigh on your spirits now, Jane, when I am close to you. Little nervous subject, forget visionary woe and think only of real happiness. You say you love me, Janet. Yes, I will not forget that, and you cannot deny it. Those words did not die inarticulate on your lips. I heard them clear and soft, a thought too solemn perhaps, but sweet as music. I think it is a glorious thing to have the hope of living with you, Edward, because I love you. Do you love me, Jane? Repeat it. I do, sir. I do, with my whole heart. Well, he said, after some minutes' silence, it is strange, but that sentence has penetrated my breast painfully. Why? I think because you said it with such an earnest religious energy, and because your upward gaze at me now is the very sublime of faith, truth, and devotion. It is too much as if some spirit were near me. Look wicked, Jane, as you know well how to look. Coin one of your wild, shy, provoking smiles. Tell me you hate me. Tease me, vex me, do anything but move me. I would rather be incensed than saddened. I will tease you and vex you to your heart's content when I have finished my tale, but hear me to the end. I thought, Jane, you had told me all. I thought I had found the source of your melancholy in a dream. I shook my head. What? Is there more? But I will not believe it to be anything important. I warn you of incredulity beforehand. Go on. The disquietude of his air, the somewhat apprehensive impatience of his manner, surprised me, but I proceeded. I dreamt another dream, sir. That Thornfield Hall was a dreary ruin, the retreat of bats and owls. I thought that of all the stately front, nothing remained but a shell-like wall, very high and very fragile-looking. I wandered, on a moonlit night, through the grass-grown enclosure within. Here I stumbled over a marble hearth, and there over a fallen fragment of cornice. Wrapped up in a shawl, I still carried the unknown little child. I might not lay it down anywhere, however tired my arms, however much its weight impeded my progress, I must retain it. I heard the gallop of a horse at a distance on the road. I was sure it was you, and you were departing for many years and for a distant country. I climbed the thin wall with frantic, perilous haste, eager to catch one glimpse of you from the top. The stones rolled from under my feet, the ivy branches I grasped gave way, the child clung round my neck in terror and almost strangled me. At last I gained the summit. I saw you like a speck on a white track, lessening every moment. The blast blew so strong I could not stand. I sat down on the narrow ledge. I hushed the scared infant in my lap. You turned an angle of the road. I bent forward to take a last look. The wall crumbled. I was shaken. The child rolled from my knee. I lost my balance, fell, and woke. Now, Jane, that is all. All the preface, sir. The tale is yet to come. On waking, a gleam dazzled my eyes. I thought, oh, it is daylight. But I was mistaken. It was only candlelight. Sophie, I supposed, had come in. There was a light in the dressing-table, and the door of the closet, where, before going to bed, I had hung my wedding-dress and veil, stood open. I heard a rustling there. I asked, Sophie, what are you doing? No one answered, but a form emerged from the closet. It took the light, held it aloft, and surveyed the garments pendant from the portmanteau. "Sophie! Sophie!" I again cried, and still it was silent. I had risen up in bed. I bent forward. First surprise, then bewilderment came over me, and then my blood crept cold through my veins. "Mr. Rochester, this was not Sophie. It was not Leah. It was not Mrs. Fairfax. It was not. No, I was sure of it, and am still. It was not even that strange woman, Grace Poole."
"It must have been one of them," interrupted my master.
"No, sir, I solemnly assure you to the contrary. The shape standing before me had never crossed my eyes within the precincts of Thornfield Hall before. The height, the contour, were new to me."
"Describe it, Jane."
"It seemed, sir, a woman, tall and large, with thick and dark hair hanging down her back. I knew not what dress she had on. It was white and straight, but whether gown, sheet, or shroud, I cannot tell."
"Did you see her face?"
"Not at first, but presently she took my veil from its place. She held it up, gazed at it long, and then she threw it over her own head and turned to the mirror. At that moment I saw the reflection of the visage and features quite distinctly in the dark oblong glass."
"And how were they?"
"Fearful and ghastly to me. Oh, sir, I never saw a face like it. It was a discoloured face. It was a savage face. I wish I could forget the roll of the red eyes and the fearful blackened inflation of the lineaments."
"Ghosts are usually pale, Jane."
"This, sir, was purple. The lips were swelled and dark, the brow furrowed, the black eyebrows widely raised over the bloodshot eyes. Shall I tell you of what it reminded me?"
"You may."
"Of the foul German spectre, the vampire."
"Ah, what did it do?"
"Sir, it removed my veil from its gaunt head, rent it in two parts, and flinging both on the floor, trampled on them."
"Afterwards?"
"It drew aside the window curtain and looked out. Perhaps it saw dawn approaching, for taking the candle it retreated to the door. Just at my bedside, the figure stopped. The fiery eyes glared upon me. She thrust up her candle close to my face and extinguished it under my eyes. I was aware her lurid visage flamed over mine, and I lost consciousness. For the second time in my life, only the second time, I became insensible from terror."
"Who was with you when you revived?"
"No one, sir, but the broad day. I rose, bathed my head and face in water, drank a long draught, felt that though enfeebled I was not ill, and determined that to none but you would I impart this vision. Now, sir, tell me who and what that woman was."
"The creature of an overstimulated brain, that is certain. I must be careful of you, my treasure. Nerves like yours were not made for rough handling."
"Sir, depend upon it, my nerves were not in fault. The thing was real. The transaction actually took place."
"And your previous dreams, were they real too? Is Thornfield Hall a ruin? Am I severed from you by insuperable obstacles? Am I leaving you without a tear, without a kiss, without a word?"
"Not yet."
"Am I about to do it? Why, the day is already commenced, which is to bind us indissolubly, and when we are once united there shall be no recurrence of these mental terrors. I guarantee that."
"Mental terrors, sir? I wish I could believe them to be only such. I wish it more now than ever, since even you cannot explain to me the mystery of that awful visitant."
"And since I cannot do it, Jane, it must have been unreal."
"But, sir, when I said so to myself on rising this morning, and when I looked round the room to gather courage and comfort from the cheerful aspect of each familiar object in full daylight, there, on the carpet, I saw what gave the distinct lie to my hypothesis, the veil, torn from top to bottom in two halves." I felt Mr. Rochester start and shudder. He hastily flung his arms round me.
"Thank God," he exclaimed, "that if anything malignant did come near you last night, it was only the veil that was harmed. Oh, to think what might have happened."
He drew his breath short and strained me so close to him I could scarcely pant. After some minutes' silence, he continued cheerily.
"Now, Janet, I'll explain to you all about it. It was half dream, half reality. A woman did, I doubt not, enter your room, and that woman was, must have been, Grace Poole. You call her a strange being yourself. From all you know, you have reason so to call her. What did she do to me? What to Mason? In a state between sleeping and waking, you noticed her entrance and her actions. But feverish, almost delirious as you were, you ascribed to her a goblin appearance different from her own. The long, dishevelled hair, the swelled black face, the exaggerated stature, were figments of imagination, results of nightmare. The spiteful tearing of the veil was real, and it is like her. I see you would ask why I keep such a woman in my house. When we have been married a year and a day, I will tell you, but not now. Are you satisfied, Jane? Do you accept my solution of the mystery?
I reflected, and in truth it appeared to me the only possible one. Satisfied I was not, but to please him I endeavoured to appear so. Relieved I certainly did feel, so I answered him with a contented smile. And now, as it was long past one, I prepared to leave him.
"Does not Sophie sleep with Adele in the nursery?"
he asked as I lit my candle.
"Yes, sir." "And there is enough room in Adele's little bed for you. You must share it with her tonight, Jane. It is no wonder that the incident you have related should make you nervous, and I would rather you did not sleep alone. Promise me to go to the nursery."
"I shall be very glad to do so, sir."
"And fasten the door securely on the inside. Wake Sophie when you go upstairs under pretence of requesting her to rouse you in good time tomorrow, for you must be dressed and have finished breakfast before 8. And now, no more sombre thoughts. Chase dull care away, Janet. Don't you hear to what soft whispers the wind has fallen, and there is no more beating of rain against the window panes? Look here."
He lifted up the curtain.
"It is a lovely night."
It was. Half heaven was pure and stainless. The clouds, now trooping before the wind, which had shifted to the west, were filing off eastward in long silvered columns. The moon shone peacefully.
"Well?"
said Mr. Rochester, gazing inquiringly into my eyes.
"How is my Janet now?"
"The night is serene, sir, and so am I."
"And you will not dream of separation and sorrow to-night, but of happy love and blissful union."
This prediction was but half fulfilled. I did not indeed dream of sorrow, but as little did I dream of joy, for I never slept at all. With little Adele in my arms, I watched the slumber of childhood, so tranquil, so passionless, so innocent, and waited for the coming day. All my life was awake and astir in my frame, and as soon as the sun rose, I rose too. I remember Adele clung to me as I left her. I remember I kissed her as I loosened her little hands from my neck, and I cried over her with strange emotion, and quitted her because I feared my sobs would break her still sound repose. She seemed the emblem of my past life, and here I was now to array myself to meet the dread but adored type of my unknown future day.
Kind of not what you'd expect for the night before your wedding. She's got some real issues going on here, and someone ripped her bridal veil in half in her bedroom at night. Somebody creepy looking. And wasn't Rochester's reaction interesting to that? That up until the point that she reports that the veil was on the floor and rent asunder, he kind of seemed to be trying to get her off the subject and kind of blow it off. And then, boom, that there's physical, factual, you can't deny it now, proof. And now he seems scared. So we've had lots of hints that something weird is going on, but we don't yet know what that something is. But we will find out soon. And that soon is next week. Now, there's the horse chestnut tree. There are a few things in Jane Eyre. I started to say in Jane's ubiquitous shawl. There are a few things in Jane Eyre that are touchstones, that are shorthand phrases and terminology that people come back to and say, oh yes, well, it's like with Gatsby, it's the green light at the end of the dock, or it's Gatsby's shirts. And people who've read the books just go, oh yeah, yep, it's that. And they let it go. It's like the joke with movie wasting disease. You go, oh, movie wasting disease. We were watching Bleak House. Oh, movie wasting disease. Well, there are a few of those with Jane Eyre, and I can't talk to you about one of the most famous ones yet, but the horse chestnut tree. Even before I had read Jane Eyre, I was familiar with the fact that there was something that happened with a horse chestnut. And when I read the book, I thought, oh, okay, so getting struck by lightning thing. So now you're left with this very important thing, because Jane has mentioned it a number of times and was there mostly when it got struck by lightning and now has gone back out on a very blustery night looking for Rochester alone, searching for him in the mist, kind of Scarlett O'Hara-like. And then she's standing there making her observations on how it's been broken and it's been killed, but that something in the roots are keeping it together. And you start to go, okay, well, what's that all about then? And it's very complicated, I think, with symbols. Because while I think there are some writers who sit down and say, okay, well, I want to symbolize this thing by using this item. I think some probably do that, but I think for the most part, it's one of the things that separates a really good writer from just a good or okay writer, is that something they're able to tap into is more primal or more Jungian and archetypal or more universal. And these things just come out of them and we recognize something in them. I have not read a whole ton of essays on the horse chestnut tree and its significance, and we can't actually talk about all the possibilities yet, but it is one of those things that, you know, let it sit at the back of your mind and see what you come up with. And post your comments in the comments and on Ravelry and share some of your ideas, because I think right now there's a huge variety of ways to go with the book for what we know of the book right now, for what the horse chestnut tree represents and symbolizes. You may change your mind next week, and that's why I think it's so cool to kind of take your pulse right now and write something down and say, okay, for right now, I haven't read the rest of the book, but for right now, this is what I think. And then next week to come back and go, yeah, boy, I'm surprised. I still think that. Or to come back and go, wow, everything's changed. I don't think that's what it is anymore. I think it's something different. It's like on 9/11 when my students and I had the plane fly into the Trade Center, which was right next to us at the school that I taught at. One of the first things I had them do, and it was admittedly really a sneaky ploy to get them away from the windows because I didn't want any of my kids to get faces full of glass. I had them sit down and write. And I said, write now. Write what you heard, write what you saw, write what you feel, write it all down, because you'll forget over time. And I think not only forget, but your memories fade and fade strangely, because it's the stuff you talk about the most that you remember the best. So if you talk about somebody else's story, you start to remember it as your own. And I wanted the kids to have that moment of originality that they could look back on and go, yeah, that was me. That's what I thought. That's what I felt. And Jane Eyre, this moment in Jane Eyre, we're on the cusp of a major turning point. Write it down. Write down your ideas. And then write them down again next week. Because everything changes. Oh, I'm so excited. I know some of you are like, I can't wait for another week. And this week, I'm actually feeling that way. It's like, oh gosh, I can't believe we're going to have to wait for the next chapter. But it's long, so I can't back it up onto this one. So on that happy note of infuriating frustration, I will leave you. You take care of yourself. Have a good one. And more Jane Eyre fun next week. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or post a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via Stitcher Radio, craftlit.com, just-the-books.com, or via our Android or iPhone app. You can also use the free Craftlit app to access premium subscriber content. Just the Books and Craftlit are made possible by the support of our listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. Just the Books and Craftlit are produced by Penny Shima Glantz and Elizabeth Green Musselman and Heather Ordover. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.